Let us bow together in prayer. May the words of my mouth and may the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. For those of you who were with us here last Sunday morning, you will remember that I began what would be then a series of three messages based on my appreciation for the contribution of Celtic Christianity, which first flourished about 1,300 years ago, beginning in Scotland and Wales and Ireland and Northern England, and then also across the mainland of Europe from about 600 to 1000 AD. I indicated last week that with the contemporary interest in spirituality, that is, finding a relevant spirituality for men and women of the 21st century who define themselves as being spiritual but not religious, there's been a concurrent interest in rediscovering our ancient heritage there in Celtic spirituality. And the reason is because it speaks with such directness to our needs today. I found it a bit of irony that I got an email this past Monday announcing the publication last month of John Philip Newell's new book, A New Harmony, subtitled The Spirit, the Earth, and the Human Soul. And along with it came the announcement of three other of his books, Celtic Prayers from Iona, Praying with the Earth, a Prayer Book for Peace, and Listening for the Heartbeat of God, a Celtic spirituality. Well, needless to say, I ordered all four immediately and trust that they may arrive before I prepare my last message in this series in order to maybe illuminate my message a little further when I focus on the role of imagination in Celtic spirituality. Now, those of you who received our weekly email and actually read it will note that this week contained a brief excerpt from Newell's book from the first chapter. So I hope you haven't thrown out this week's email. Well, last week I spoke about one aspect of Celtic spirituality, namely experiencing the presence of God in all of life, and experiencing that presence as protective against any powers of evil and darkness. This morning I want to draw our attention to another aspect of Celtic Christianity, which I think is of utmost significance and is receiving a lot of interest and appreciation from many contemporary theologians and religious writers. And I would call it a conviction of the goodness of nature, the goodness of all of the created order, including humankind. It is the love of life, taking joy in and enjoying all that gives pleasure, including the sensual and the sexual. Having these bodies of ours, not considering them as evil flesh, but good because all that God created and has given to us is good. Last month, those of you who participated in the book discussion on Barbara Brown Taylor's book, An Altar in the World, remember that we expanded on that theme of even saying, when you get up in the morning, can you stand naked in front of the mirror and say, thank you for this body that's been given, even with its wrinkles and I won't refer to this, okay. But I must say that this is not the good news that I was taught when I was growing up. That was not part of my religious upbringing in Randolph Heights Presbyterian Church in St. Paul, Minnesota. It was not part of the religious teaching at Minnehaha Academy, the private Christian high school that I attended, with the motto, where youth meets truth. I was taught much more about sin than about natural goodness. The emphasis was placed on withdrawing from everything branded as worldly. That is, anything that seemed to give pleasure, rather than really embracing it. If I remember correctly, the first thing I learned as to who human beings are is that we are sinners from which we need to be redeemed. We were heavy on the doctrine of original sin, which was defined for us as passed along through the sins of our parents and their parents and their parents. Thus, even as one looked at a newborn baby in the arms of its mother, you could still declare that that little one is a sinner needing redemption. And though I imagine many of you, even as myself, felt uncomfortable with that thought, you still felt that that was part of our tradition, and perhaps we were taught that. The last year that I was serving in Merritt before I came out here, on a particular Sunday morning during my vacation period, I was invited to conduct worship and preach in our sister Presbyterian church in Roslyn. That church at the time was without a pastor. And I was told that I would be baptizing a baby during the service. Now, meeting with the parents earlier in the week, I had the opportunity to talk with them about the meaning of baptism. And the mother quickly interjected, "Do Presbyterians believe in original sin? I have never felt comfortable with the idea of original sin," she said. "That little Dylan here needs to be baptized to cleanse him from his sin." Dylan's mother had been taught that in her confirmation class. But she said she always questioned it. "So am I said to her. I felt her question had thrown me once again into that situation in which we clergy often find ourselves of trying to explain something in concise, simple terms when what we have been asked has been the subject of a furious theological debate for centuries. But in this particular situation, it was even worse, for I was being asked to explain something that I myself had difficulty understanding or explaining or even wondering if I believed it at all. I didn't want to do injustice to the forefathers of our faith, for this was an important doctrine for them. I remember telling her that the Christian faith had talked about two great stories from the book of Genesis, which is the book of beginnings. One is the story of creation, and the other is the story of the fall or the sin of Adam and Eve there in the garden. The first story wishes to stress that we are made in the image of God, and the second stresses that in the action of Adam and Eve, that image has been damaged. It's been marred, but not lost. And the story of the fall is an attempt to explain what we have all experienced, namely that universal propensity to rebel against God's sovereignty by setting ourselves at the center of the universe, the place which belongs to God alone. The problem is, however, in our preaching and teaching, we've given much more attention to the fall than to the original creation. And then I quip, we give more attention to original sin than to original blessing. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to attend a lecture at Stony Brook in which the speaker was Matthew Fox. I know that Catherine was at the same meeting. At the time, he was Father Matthew Fox, a Roman Catholic in good standing and a member of the Dominican Order, and an outstanding scholar whose work centered primarily on the early church fathers and then on the mystics, particularly Meister Eckhart. Matthew Fox has given his whole life to discover a contemporary Christian spirituality. And his most notable book is titled Original Blessing. The book led to Fox being silenced. That's the official term used by the Catholic Church. He was silenced in 1989 and later was actually defrocked. He was kicked out of the Dominican Order in 1993. He is now an Episcopal priest. He's the author of 30 books and a proponent of a movement that has come to be known as creation spirituality. One of the interesting events that has taken place in Fox's life was on Pentecost Sunday in 1995. He nailed a 95 thesis in German to the door at Wittenberg, where four centuries earlier, Martin Luther had done the same. And that particular act led to his writing the book, A New Reformation. Well, I recently learned that he's just published his newest book, another one that I'm going to be ordering. If you wonder where my salary goes, it goes to buy books. Okay. The new book is called The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved. Fox asks us to discard the whole doctrine of original sin and develop a new theology which celebrates the goodness of creation. Well, of course, this is not a new theology at all. And I think Fox himself quickly would point that out. It runs throughout the scriptures. Listen again to the words that Linda read this morning from the 8th Psalm. What are human beings that you are mindful of these mortals, that you care for them? You've made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and with honor. Our Christian Celtic forebears were well aware of the power of evil and sin in the world, but they also espoused a creation-centered spirituality, worshiping the Lord of creation who is revealed fully and characteristically in the wonders and the splendors of the whole natural order. Even John Calvin declared, and I quote, and I don't quote Calvin that often, the world is the theater of God's glory. That's a beautiful phrase. Calvin's deserves being quoted a second time. The world is the theater of God's glory. You know, in the artwork which the Celtics have left us, their most tangible legacy of their celebration of creation. If you would note that the borders of their illustrations in their illuminated manuscripts are often made up of intertwining patterns of fruit and foliage. The distinctive feature of the Celtic cross is that circle of creation representing the earth and the sun which surrounds and encompasses the cross. Celtic theology stressed the essential goodness of nature, including human nature, and saw Jesus Christ as the one who came not so much to rescue the world from the consequences of the fall as to complete and perfect it. It is this emphasis on the goodness of creation that gave impetus to science, not as being at war with religion, but as a partner with religion in discovering the awe and the wonder of the whole created order. For us today, to rediscover the Celtic spiritual tradition would inaugurate new possibilities between spirituality and science, transforming the way we look at life. And I think we need that, particularly in this day where we must give attention to the destruction of the created order and where the environment and ecology are really in jeopardy today. Matthew Fox has said it so succinctly. We need to move from an ecological to an ecological consciousness. If Calvin can be quoted twice, so can Fox. We need to move from an ecological to an ecological consciousness. Go back and read again those words printed in your bulletin for a time of reflection, and you will find there, I trust, not only a revelation of God in all of the created order, but also a mandate to save this planet from environmental destruction. But just as important in Celtic spirituality as the goodness of nature is the goodness of human nature, not as corrupt and degenerate, but as imprinted with the image of God, full of potential, full of opportunity, longing for completion. Christ is presented in Celtic thought as the great liberator, setting us free to be what we were created to be and do what we were created to do. Now, this is a continuing process, as given image by that Celtic knot, which I described last week as expressing constant movement, perpetual motion, not frenzy, but a definite pattern and order and controlled motion. The great call of liberation for the entire created order, liberation for each and every one of us. In the words of St. Patrick, Christ there to restore me. Amen. Let us now affirm our faith using these words of St. Patrick. Please stand if you are able. I bind unto myself today the virtues of the starlit heaven, the glorious sun's life-giving rays, the whiteness of the moon at even, the flashing of the lightning free, the whirling wind's tempestuous shocks, the stable earth, the deep salt sea around the old eternal rocks. Christ be with me, Christ within me, Christ behind me, Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to win me, Christ to comfort and restore me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ in quiet, Christ in danger, Christ in hearts of all that love me, Christ in the mouth of migrant and stranger. You may be seated.